Letbury Poetry Festival is delighted to have you and you all here, and we are supported by the Arts Council as well as the Foyle Foundation to make this happen. But now, join me in giving a warm welcome to the 2015 winners, Geraldine Clarkson, David Hawkins, Simon Jenner, and Judge Sarah Howe.
Hello, everyone. Thank you so much for showing up this afternoon. It's wonderful to see you all and to have the pleasure of introducing these three marvellous poets who I came to know initially as pieces of paper with numbers on them. So it's sort of strange for me to meet them as embodied human beings now. I can say actually that I remember the moments when each of their individual poems showed up in the pile. I think that was the quality that marked out the ones that lasted the whole long stretch till the very, very end, that you needed to come back to them again. So I'm here in my capacity, along with David Wheatley and Esther Morgan, as having been one of the judges of the 2015 competition. And it was a fascinating and in some ways grueling and immensely rewarding experience judging the Poetry Society's National Poetry Competition. It started with four huge A4-sized boxes full of paper being shipped across the Atlantic, where I was living for the year. And that was where my few months of getting acquainted with lots and lots and lots of poems in volumes that you've never really encountered before and never would normally in life began. So there were 12,000 entries to the competition that year, and each of us judges read an overlapping two-thirds. So over this autumn and winter, I read 9,000 poems and was reading them on Christmas Day before we sat down to watch Jurassic World together. And I don't regret it at all. And I was going to say that the experience was a bit like a marathon, except you can probably tell that I've never run a marathon, because it was an experience that got more and more enjoyable towards the end. And I'm not sure that's how marathons usually go. Maybe they do. But as I said, it was this quality of the poems that we set to one side for coming back to. There was a sort of magnetism to them that you felt the need to go back to that pile. And as it became smaller and smaller, there was a quality of nourishment that those poems that remained gave, and I think you'll hear that from our poets today. I'm going to introduce each of them in turn, so I'll come up to the stage each time, and I'm going to tell you a little bit about them and then read some of our judging comments about their individual poems so that you can get a sense of why we thought they were so special. So first up is Simon Jenner. Simon was born in Cookfield in 1959. This did make me laugh, the modesty of his bio. He says, failing everything except art, he learnt to fly instead. Discovering poetry forestalled a career in airframes. He has been the director of Survivors Poetry since 2003 and has published several collections. He has books forthcoming from Perdiker, Poet in the City, and Agenda Editions. And my fellow judge, David Wheatley, said of Simon's work, some poems shine out, but others are opalescent, to use a word from Simon Jenner's Peter Phillips Part book, Talks to Bruegel, a wonderful window onto counter-reformation, counterfactual history, making music by chorusing the pitch of love across five centuries. This is Simon.
Thank you, Sarah, and to everybody at Ledbury. My father managed to engender me through a tin leg. This is largely because he was smuggling Durex through to the Meath Hospital from Belfast, and one consignment perished in his stump seat, and I and probably several others were born, but he had another use for his tin leg. This is called 19 Keir Street, St. Louis. My father, terrified, a poltergeist, balancing around the stairwell in 1953, to the crash of phantom bone china, at the spirit level of the bedroom window, as the blanched bedsheets shot off my uncle to the apocalypse cry of visitors, fuck off! My father flung his phantom limb. A wrenched-off phantom, Geralumin, bearing Paris Durex, smuggled through to all the medics of the Meath. A broke-off, months-off, gossamer-conceiving, pewter, tenuta, and back again, came silence, the laid-out terror. And now he's dead, appears to my cousin, and both my legs plant a solid standing, spawned from his phantom cancelled limb. Fuck off to a future tense of ghosts, to frighten our cupboards out of skeletons, to know the mineral cry of ghosts can only empty or fill a room. That and the next poem come from my first collection, full collection, over there about bloody time, just to mention. Back numbers, everyone's been around some kind of BBC set. You know, in Brighton, you it's thick with them, and you stumble them, you have a love affair, and you find out it's been used for a television series. Well, here we go, back numbers. Suddenly, this jade 1810 window seat was more than Becky Sharp's, lifted from being the original cosmopolitan prop for sin, shuddering this now illicit wood into our first tart juices. Lust for your athlete shiver, my trigger-haired werewolf shoulders were a silent grasp of responsibility. Coming downs so sadly into words, delicate, I coax your back's huge scab to judder off and think of Goethe. On her back's his fingers struck to meet her, on her back's unblemished rise and fall to an earth of his loving. Yours, gently pocked, scars lunar. Too far, it still provokes my alien touch to the way this has no easy scanning. But you're inspired as if to save me. I sang to the rhythm of your snores. Your thighs are not English. A couple from the next collection. One's called Love, Etc. This is my Welsh part of my family. My mother lives in Carmarthen, and she was propositioned by Dylan Thomas when she was 17, and then he died. Yeah, I'm not sure what that made for her, but she ended up actually being in the cast of the first cast for the Irish cast under Milkwood. She criticised them for their language and ended up being on the Gate Theatre stage. Love, Etc. There's no Welsh for orgasm. That conjugate language, that's my mother's tongue, she told me. That the Dublin nurse quizzed her fill to a home voice whisper. Did you feel a thrill? Probing the throaty colloquial through the gap in her teeth where the Gaelic whistled a gulp empty. It's a space between eros, agape. For the Anglo-Saxons, love, the caress for what you possess, lost, desire for what's not yours, the taking mend, words men wrote, like mucus opals, hardening to horses. Love, fragile, amore, sucks or shivers through the teeth. Women with a breath inspire children they can't own from death, but blow through their warm earth, had to insinuate through their teeth, introduce their tongue to common men, and hope love's palate might harden. I thought I'd, with a rather heavyweight poem at the end, I thought I'd produce a few love lyrics or lust lyrics in the middle, so if we have time, I might divert somewhere else, but we'll see. ID, intelligent design. As you can imagine, I have a bit of fun with that. You said the clitoris is the best argument for intelligent design, but the devout won't swallow it, a woman's gift over nature, with no closed season on self-pleasurers. For the postmodern, there's a shiver too. Bodies aren't ironic, however you pierce them with a scorn for the voyeur, lust says back to the sweet skin sinner. It's between me and your allure. Relax to it, only lust answers. Your voice sashes between the camp of license and Leviticus and red lamps. A burst fig for words that abuse the tongue, formed for other silent missions. This is a poet who was immensely involved as a writer and a critic with, I can't actually give her a surname because there's a, well, frankly, extramarital affair involved, but she was one of Geoffrey Hill's great scholars. Anyway, somebody will know about this, but it's called The Heavens to Betsy. On a sabbatical from dying, you met me, breathless between semesters. We talked the future leather, black, tight, where I cupped the hollow of your breasts, felt your heart's willed skip, the flutter of give halfway. Our other halves, quarters. I make a distinction between loyalty and faithfulness. Precise in desire, as fibrillating hills, clotted Eden of the ear. Your wisdom, wiry, then voluptuous laughter, hit me between your inscriptions and your kiss, both printed indelibly in your ink, blonde time, cascading your ashen hair over me as white cells waited their turn to write me, but that was in another country, as I mailed you Louis Banish Desmarest motets, then again as you passed it to someone iller, eliciting an encore of the same music for you only. Your bone-fingered, sad platonics said, prepare for what divides breasts already. Right. Have I got about 3 minutes left? Or a bit longer? Pardon? 3 minutes. Okay, I'll just do this one. It's called The Periodic Charm, and it's self-explanatory, I hope. Dear cousin of inert gases, be argonaut of your concave heart, of its stilly receptacles and reflexive verbs, of patience taught to name's transaction, to how you swerve sceptical figures to your long-nosed displacement. Steer your charge's involutions from sad, but from yourself, once the helium you meant laughter simple with, to the neon mad labelled through your argon-probing journey, past Scylla's clutched abuses, Charybdis whirlpool memory, calling the bark away to drown, salt oblivion's Judas kiss, delicate with your krypton's unlocking. You've enriched and encrypted heads with minting the key, not hurriedly pressing it to them, but touching hair filament threads for answers they make light on. Kind Diogenes, whose Zeon tries enameled compasses of so fraught asylum seekers, refugees from continents tectonic, that presses skull sutures from trauma, that dreams black. Keep your scientists' once bright qualities as plummet from your vertiginous track down the human scale. It's tabled gravitas you take on with that quiet of periodic fire. No Celsius of Geiger breathes on. Tender Illuminati, wry chemic, refuter of phasing heads, starred with your radon. Right, I better finish with this. Peter Phillips' part book talks to Bruegel, the poem that a placenta or whatever. I think there's lots of opacities, mucuses, and a whole range of things running through these. Very briefly, Bruegel painted the parts of music. They were inscribing the 1618. It was in 1618 of Peter Phillips, a recusant poet who'd done a bunk over to Antwerp to, you know, avoid some rather nasty viscoration. He wasn't as protected as William Byrd. And here we have the crux of somebody who was painted in, and therefore he's talking out of his painting of his own musical instruments or actual scores. England blisters from me. I'll grow a new skin in Antwerp, where the declivities of the word recusant press no unnatured furrows on my back, nor delve a harrow through my conscience. What shall I say, Bruegel? My vellum flays cream open to the touch of your eyeballs and lead, jacketed in this precipitate white smear. Your sense of hearing, Seven Desks, an old thing, my first book of madrigals, pricked on lead lozenges, so legible in north morning light, flat off the channel.
I've put out so much since. All Europe listens. Now you, and they to you, through what sloped ear you've fixed me in. I've this dream that these squirrel notes will be my all, captive to varnish, yellowing time to bitumen's oblivion. I was never tortured till now by a friend blonde in his good wishes, like an angel of those instrumented orders they once applied on walls, tempera, aplacent with light, singing their clear grey levels of ascension. But I'm here whited by you, as if my skin's exposed to my own black arrows of invention, coral to just 1 minute of me, again, again, voicing each part as if a door opened, shut. Is this my touch of gratitude to your wrist, my sweet-toned inquisition? Forgive my skin talking. I'm stretched and sized and think on the death that tautens me. I paper Europe with my cry, as if then the chanson uncurled to God, absolves these vanities with crisp silence, and my stands chorus the pitch of love forever. Thank you.
I think it's fitting that Simon's last two poems there brought together a recusant poet fleeing religious discrimination from 4 centuries ago and the current refugee and migrant crisis. One of the most fascinating and compelling things about judging the competition this year was seeing the recurring themes that came up in the poems we were reading. It was almost like taking the temperature of the nation, seeing what was floating about in the collective unconscious, what people needed to write about. On the one hand, it was incredibly various. There were poems about every realm of human experience you could imagine, from caring for elderly parents to the fallout of war to... actually, we always hear about cat poems, but this year the dog lovers definitely won out. There were many, many more canine poems than feline odes this time. But above all, one of the abiding preoccupations of the poems that were sent in was the migrant crisis, and poems written about the experience, even sometimes in the voices of refugees, which I think shows how... poets writing these days, people writing poems these days, won't shy away from the difficult things that there are in our world to write about, however hard that is. I mentioned variety just now, and this wasn't a conscious principle of selection on our part at all, but we were delighted to see just how varied the winning and commended poems that we chose were. They were very, very different to each other, and I think you'll hear that even in with the three poets reading for you this afternoon. Our next poet is David Hawkins, who is a writer, journalist, editor, and ecologist from Bristol. He grew up on the banks of the Severn estuary and read English at New College, Oxford, then worked for several years in art history publishing, then retraining as a botanist and habitat surveyor. His particular interests include the intersections of landscape and time and human activity. He has work in a recent book from Dunlin Press, The Migrant Waders. David was a founding editor of the wonderful Like Starlings poetry website, which I encourage you all to read if you haven't already. And David's expertise as an ecologist and botanist, you can definitely see it in his winning poem. My fellow judge, David Wheatley, said, "Do we write landscape poems or do they write themselves through us? Long distance relationship with a mountain is a poem of luminous mystery. This is poetry as field composition, assembling, mapping, thinking with these hills to summon the wonders of place into being before the reader's eyes. Please welcome David Hawkins.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much. Thank you to Sarah and to the Ledbury Poetry Festival and to the Poetry Society. Thank you. This is called Fire Watching. Outposted to a hill whose courageous distances still don't have names. Each footstep new as a native word for fresh leaves, dew-stung and rubbery. Weeks passed in the crow's nest, its towering silence made of wind and dreams and treetops. Meditations on the infinite colours contained in the sky, on the infinitude of colours emptying from skies, came naturally as migrants returning. Warblers' sudden bright points from nowhere reappearing, jostled between the fire breaks. We slept through whole seasons, our souls more awake than ever. Pages and pages of sky to study, the horizon enveloping itself, books heavy and teeming as leaf mould in the ash-quiet forest. Until a great eyelid of snow swept in with the same ease, and each would knapsack their unique trail in reverse. If such work existed nowadays, looking for smoke or signs of flight in a vast uninhabited country, untroubled save by myths of fire, when a poem might map right to the edge and then try to go that bit further. Thank you. This is called The Beach at the End of the World, and it's, I suppose it is it's a kind of field composition in retrospect. Australia is still a dream under lugworm burrows. The mission was to dig deep enough and fast enough to keep the water out of the tunnel until you could cry out to the bunyip and the koala and the upside-down sky. Where to excavate? Cardigan Bay teased winter handfuls out of the soft cliffs, so every year the land was smaller and the beach got nearer. A set of wooden steps placed by the council to aid access would climb the sea air into nothing just weeks later. Every summer, the beach would be reborn as a unique formation of sand and stones and purple cloud shadows scrolling across our lives. Leaping rock pools, stirring crabs, shimmering the feathers of cormorants, drying themselves on slanting clotheslines. Beach cricket is an urgent thing when the field shrinks with the rising tide. Easier and easier to find the boundary as it thunders in, and to lose the ball to the slaloming waves, to watch it drift off towards Australian children, no doubt doing exactly the same as us. There was often one spectator. With sudden stillness, a grey seal would be watching from its dark island of seaweed, toothed rack and bladder rack, thick fuscous browns pelted by the luminous grey sea. Survivalists, we would gather driftwood as if it was a ritual, and wait for odd colours to emerge from the flames. Night came down with a new angle each time, the sound of a tunnel being filled in. Every lugworm dreams of the Antipodes from its horseshoe-shaped burrow, starts down so intently, but always curves back on itself to the same surface, the same distant stretch of shore. This next one's curious. I used to think that I was very good at recognising people's faces, not necessarily putting a name to them, but being able to place where I'd seen them. But I've sort of noticed as the years have gone on, time's gone on, that I might recognise a face, but it seems to be shuffled in the mind as to where on earth you first encountered this person, and if in fact you did encounter them, and if there's just something about them that seems oddly familiar. So there's a bit of that in here, along with a little bit of the Mabinogion, perhaps. Just trying to hang on to an idea of something truly terrifying, which for me would be doing a skydive. So this is a skydive at night, and I don't know if people do them, but it would be quite frightening to do a skydive at night, I reckon. Possibly less so than in the day. Skydive at night. Earth splendouring up at the speed of just afterwards. Cities, towns and villages constellate, then burst. Long roads splinter into opalescent distance that blues and deepens without end. Are you listening to the limitless and blooming and evolving? Is that our house ricocheting around in my consciousness? For things tired of being things, this twilight cadence is anti-venom. Trying to catch the fall's binomial as it alters, reclassifies, melds with silence. Co-terminal velocity. Many of the centrifugal faces of those falling with me look like schoolmates I haven't spoken to in years. But their names have been changed too. Minds laced with scattering minds. Their fugitive words gentle away. Hammered dulcimers of light from hamlets and farmsteads, strong in the synapses. Try to imagine the sleeping brows crumpled into each box room, the real messages behind each windowing page, simplifying a childhood dream of falling, adding fractal decisions to every mistrodden stepping stone of air. After all, their voices were carefully recorded, but in an old, untransferable format. Tell your husband that these terrors will pass, so that he also may alight in a valley of yes, okay, and dance, and be a polecat or a wild boar, if he so chooses, scratching its back on a hawthorn stump. And so from identities kind of lost or petering out, to a story about an identity assumed. This is called Caretaker. The jumpers are a bit too big, as if for a larger woman, but their weave is complex and patterned with perfect vernacular. They are the garments of an insider. You wouldn't guess that someone else's hairs are threaded through the cable knits like a well-laid hedge, pleached and kept, so no wind can unpick it. She wears them anyway, about her business. There's nothing mysterious in that. The air is sharp as a blotted sloe, that bloom you take off with your thumb. A moon-faced sun tickles the sky's misty throat. She slides her hand around a palm-smooth stick, strides well-worn steps up Ancheard Hill, calls familiar sheep across a tumbling field. They are ornamental, no less pets than the dogs. The crows look mob-like, so she ducks through that same hole in the hedge, the one you have to learn. No letters come, no calls, no one visits. But the dogs answer to her almost unguardedly. They were trained that way in a past life. Wrote sincerity in the dusting of ornaments and souvenirs from holidays to places she's never been. The garden path looks just the same, but tangles and slips like a cat's cradle as soon as you step onto its moss-limbed edges. Dark upstairs windows wield their umbrage over a tentative chaos of rambler roses, as if the house has parted ways with reason, the most gradual and subtle of repossessions. At evening, the glass of gin, tremulous and neat, as clear and illusory as a way back, lend the illegitimate byways to get here, returning unprovenanced, as if to claim this odd non-heritance, strangered by the town. Everyone too grief-confused to argue the point, or point to an argument, or to know how to have sympathy for someone who happened on a lucky death. Quite pleased there's cats and dogs in there, actually. So. Finally, this is the poem for which I was favourably rewarded, and it's called Long Distance Relationship with a Mountain. We got our hefting up here, all right. The wind curling round us visibly, curing us, as if we were stones to be placed and lichen dappled with glacial deliberation. And now, thinking with these hills, a wandering sentence can be levelled between them, tested against the mean of willful horizon and capricious sky. Grey-brown, green-black, lutulent river, drawn easily as a snagged thread, pulling the best effects of the valley with it. Light hurdles swiftly into huge stands of pines, and hides there with great abandon, intimate with the windage creaks and groans in the crowns of these self-shredding trees, brashed and rusting beneath it. Pulled back the thick curtain of moss, and found wheel ruts slanting through the Ordovician. Pulled back at the false summit, and wandered towards a trig point, decentered in the mist. Spectral sheep splay tarsily among the drop-skied moors, while someone else is summiting surely in their own homemade uplands. A snipe whittles up from a cloak of rushes, and I try to keep its ember alight with my eye until with perfect clearance it falls off the edge, or edges beyond seeing. A particular breeze tugs its harmonic, adjusted to our hearing. We are earmarked, as across the Irish Sea, a shadow range of mountains echoes unsayably. Here, the so-called Black Road, on its endless ancient traverse over the ridge, intersects the local corpse road that looks to another false summit, before the tireless sway of the Atlantic, the real inheritance, looking at ravens, waiting for their croak in the welcoming gloom. The names of all the rocks make their own ground. Thank you very much.
We're on to the final stretch now, and before I forget, I should really encourage you all to enter this year's National Poetry Competition, which is open now and will be until the 31st of October. And I think there are even these pretty leaflets which you can pick up at the back of the room, which are entry forms, I think. This year's competition is going to be judged by Maniza Alvey, Jerry Cambridge and Jack Underwood. So if you feel like you would like to be up here this time next year reading, do give it a go. One of the other pleasures of judging the competition was the shift of attention that it demanded. I guess we're so used to thinking of poetry books as books, but there was something lovely about slowing down to consider and savour and weigh just the single poem for its own merits and strengths and ability to stand by itself. It was very interesting when we came to the point of revealing the identification numbers and translating them into names, that we spotted that actually in our long list of the final 100, several poets had managed to make it in multiple times. And I think Geraldine Clarkson, our last reader today, would win the prize if there were such a thing for managing to get the most poems into the final 100, because apart from her commended poem, she had several in that bunch. But I don't think that we as judges were conscious that they were all by the same person, so much did they each stand on their own. In fact, Geraldine's successes in recent competitions are so numerous that I'm going to have to just give you the edited highlights. She was a winner in the 2015 Ambit Poetry Competition, as well as the 2015 Poetry London Competition, the 2015 Magma Editors Prize and Ver Prize. She is also one of four winners of the Poetry School Nine Arches Press Primers Scheme in 2015. She was a Writers' Centre Norwich Escalator winner in 2011 and shortlisted for the Arvon competition in 2010. Her first chapbook, Declare, is forthcoming from Shearsman in the early summer, and a second pamphlet, Dora Incites the Sea Scribbler to Lament, isn't that a fantastic title, has been selected as a Laureate's Choice and will be published by Smith Doorstop in late 2016. So you'll be hearing a lot more from and about Geraldine in the coming months, I think. This is what I said about her commended poem at the time, and I think it still rings true for me. The instincts of a great storyteller guide each twist in St. Rose of Lima's Revenge. The poem brings a distant era and struggle to life with an ear for searing detail. And as you'll hear from the poem, that is a rather mischievous pun, which I think is a mischievous that is borne out by the delightfulness of Geraldine's work. So please welcome her to the stage.
Thank you very much to Sarah and your fellow judges and to Ledbury Poetry Festival and to the Poetry Society. I was really thrilled that this particular poem was chosen for a commendation. I spent several years in Peru and heard a lot about St. Rose of Lima. And I shall begin with St. Rose of Lima's Revenge. At a rough-backed hour, wound round with olive light,
the pink-cheeked would-be anchorite slides past date palms and scarlet trumpet lilies in the colonial garden, intent on the far spinney where wiry trees like acolytes surround a simple hut her heart always skips to reach. Holy time, before the porcelain-jowled suitors, damn them, begin to queue, their arms and brows pale as the dough which Madre leaves to rise in the sideways sun, their insect voices urgent and mi querido-ing as they bend low to moan her name. Always, always she is called back just when Hermano's son peeks up to play, called back along the manicured paths, the geometric beds, called back from the bossy place, cloaked in verde, and all alone with the beloved expected. Called in by a maid as Señor so-and-so is waiting and his father is so importante, pretty Rosita. She makes lace and takes stupendous blooms to market to support the house, though many in the city are much worse off, mami. Some of these she brings to her room to rinse and bind till nightfall. Then, though drooping, keeps vigil to cultivate that sweet edge of encounter and grow oleander-like, glossy with blessing. This siesta time she flits again, lizards skid on scalding sand, down to the cool grotto for an hour in eucalyptus and blueberry, till again some Raphael or Gregorio in the lobby. And oh, the slippery grasping insistence when you are so spent and your legs and arms so limp and the cushions in the parlour so soft and grateful. Ah, but she'll show them. She plucks two pods as she passes in at the kitchen door, scores their seams, then draws moist flesh and virgin seeds across her eyelids and cheeks like a society lady's brightener. And they begin to smart and swell. Ah, my Rosa, at last her mother turns, then gasps at Rosa's eyes dancing and red, the perfect skin puckering into pustules, fresh chili juice dripping at her fingertips. The suitors look and look away, but then, covertly, look again. When I got the call about the commendation, I was in New York and Judith phoned at about 7 a.m. and the previous day I'd visited St. Patrick's Cathedral and I'd lit a candle at the shrine of St. Rose of Lima, so I thought that was very auspicious. My brand new pamphlet, this is the very first time I've read from it, is out now. And I'm going to keep with the monastic and Peruvian theme and read a poem deriving from my time in Peru when I was in a monastic community. And it was at a time when there was quite a lot of terrorism in the country, both inside and outside the community. For our extinguished guests. So Mother Abbess delays a few days in the selva, adventures alongside the laity, in toucan-touched rainforest, tickled by tiger light striping her habit. She turns frisonista at the thought of real terrorists laired up with jaguars and monkeys, brushes breasts against copaiba, pretty malva, thick-set cedar, steers the tour guide past poisonous pencil snakes, then strikes out for her own territory, the desert, and slick monastic gig she runs on the skirts of a shanty town at the edge of a tip, rubbing shoulders with rubbish, presents her travelling companion. The father, clicked into guest quarters, is corn-fed and watered by pale nuns who come and go with purple morada, iced lemon, and a yard broom to keep the steps clear of sand. Their eyes dart low, bright blue. He thirsts for his arum lily, his daughter, transplanted, imagines her growing twisted amongst similar. He asks questions, raises eyebrows in Spanish, flicks copper roaches from pillows, ticks off gold mornings, throbbing with scarlet-tongued flowers. Activities are arranged. The beach, Museum of the Sea, He glimpses her three times a day through the grill. The daughter, inside the enclosure, dreams of peacocks and snow, rises earlier, collides with a junta of nuns who, as if playing chess, devise urgent sweeping, singing and scaling of fish, keep her busy, no visits, his ticket expires. Ceremonial farewells, they hug. She smuggles a shell to her mother, give nothing unless the abbess allow. Then watches planes, which might be his, arc the desert, the selva of paired birds, painted rainforests, terrorists, the mountains away. Soon after, she breaches the cloister wall, arcs the desert and selva and mountains herself, returns to her father, November, fireworks like gunshots, brief birds climbing the night, and the original wall, made of muscle and will. And my family background is Irish, and family gatherings always end with a sing-song in varying degrees of drunkenness. And I used to be fascinated as a child by all the different themes that ran through the songs, and in common with a lot of other folk traditions as well. And this poem from Primus uses some of those phrases and themes, and also imagines a time when, with Ireland's troubled history, the culture and the very language were suppressed. When Tooraloos were taboo, the old folks crouched in the hedges, soft peat leaking between their toes, rubber bands curbing their fingers, in a backspin as they tried to master the new rules. Their tongues were trained in different shapes from the ones the government was allowing now. Their throats, once oiled with jugs of punch, knees freighted with pretty wenches one fine morning in May, June or July, by the mountains of Mourne or the cliffs of Dunedin, wishing, wishing, wishing in vain to be maids or youths again. Even whistles were prescribed, and the joyful jig of the accordion abandoned, which had set knees and heels reeling and tapping. She said, "Come in, sir, and meet my father." Who knew when a Tooraloo would break loose and what it would do? In the end, you could always escape across the main, as many had before Tooraloora, to Californiae, and instead of singing praties, you'd be singing lumps of gold, Tooraloorale. And I have a very large family, a lot of brothers, and tragically we lost one brother when I was very little, and this next poem, it's a very little poem, is about him. The family didn't deal with it very well, and it affected us all for a long time. Brother. Not the physical boy, but the masculine shadow, cruciform over the family, fixed from eldest to youngest, sprinting alongside as well as over us, quick to fill our mouths to stop us from mentioning his name, leapfrogging into the space where joy was, long jumping through the marrow where his disease had been. And we were death-struck, dumb, not realising he only wanted to play. And I'll go from brothers to wives. And this poem won a competition last year. His wife in the corner. When he had finished offering me the world and stretched up to switch on the light, and looked back with a curious green glow in his eyes, his cheeks pumped out and young-looking, at his handiwork, me lying there replete, a jetted calf, pinioned, a vodka bottle nodding in the hollow between us like it had some fang-dang urgent message. I felt like I was 14 and had raced in my lunch hour to the store with the jade velvet jacket in the window, carried on a wave of longing and with all the confidence of sudden money, only to be met in the lobby by the assistant in civvies saying, "We don't open on Tuesdays." And his wife in the corner, dressed sharp and rocking violently, her gorgeous green lapels rising and falling with mirth. And I'll end with a poem about my hometown. I see there's somebody else from my hometown here. And it's a spa town with a lot of beautiful Georgian architecture. And a lot of the old buildings of the town have turned into very expensive apartments, but many of them still retain the facade, the original facade, and the name of what they used to be, like the old post office, the old school, and so on. And so that comes into this poem, which is "Afflatus in my hometown." I eat perflux and paper flying sideways in the dust. I pull soft conversations from the bones of old men jawing at bus stops about horses' form and ale. Small girls look broken and mended wrong. I lick them over. I cannot believe I have been mute here so long, in these grand avenues under this low, flat wind, where everything is old, the old school, the old post office, the old library, all turned to high-end shelves. We are living like wraiths, women fixed in flux so familiar it's stasis, black eyes accepting nothing, marital breath sour and agonal. We hold wrong in our fists. Wasted, I look for food, some viaticum to get me home. Paper and perflux ingested for no more than jesting. Party words passed round like canapé when we should scream, or else keep silence so extreme it might be counted as currency to buy us out. Our people are eating bitter palliatives in a bound world, and where breath should blow in churches, it's kept in check in tomes by those who treasure thrift and handle special keys. The breath rattles tabernacle doors, coughing between leaves while thin lips importune us. The dead, too, accompany us, uncomprehending of worsted blankets which we hunch around our ears when we are wronged, worsted by circumstance. I can scarcely believe I have been silent this far, imbricated in psychic architecture, like a snail carrying sweet freight bent on inching flight. I mimic enjoyment, jouissance, thrillless sin. My ego, an outré gent, gaunt with pleasure, opal-strung. He kisses me slow, with garlic tongue and rubbish skill, till I become perflex, paper shifting and oil-stained in alien hands. Thank you very much for listening.
On behalf of the Poetry Society and my fellow judges, hearty congratulations again to you all. And so for our readers this afternoon, Simon, David and Geraldine, a big round of applause.